Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's show. It's episode 666, which means I am joined by much gnashing of teeth for this very special episode where we're going to talk about our favorite devil movies by Satan himself, Beelzebub.
Thank you for finally having me on the podcast. Worship me.
We were going to have you on to talk Batman versus Superman, but your schedule didn't work back then.
Worship me, all you podcast listeners. Know the joy of total evil.
So we're going to talk about movies where we like your portrayal in film, Devil.
That's the sound of gnashing of teeth.
All right, okay. Devil, how do you make so much time to be in movies?
Well, the answer is simple. It's you learn to delegate. You learn to delegate authority to lesser demons. Listen, Patrick Bromley.
Yeah.
Worship. Okay. This is going to destroy my larynx. So we're going to drop the devil thing. And,
all right.
Let's just, okay?
Please welcome to the show, JB.
Did we do the devil thing enough? I think that was about a minute and a half. We're going to talk about movies where we like or appreciate or think it's fun the way the devil's portrayed. And we'd like to thank the listener who put a comment on the podcast, I think two or three podcasts ago. And this young, I'm guessing it was a young man, was so excited, like, we're at 664. I wonder what those crazies are going to do for 666. And that's what gave us the idea. So thank you.
That was Maddie Kukulka.
Thank you.
Our Ninja Turtles 2 podcast. Because to be honest, before that point, I didn't even think about doing something for 666.
Because if I remember correctly, I read that comment and I texted you and I'm like, what are we doing? What are we doing, boss?
I don't know. Batman versus Superman.
You know, both of their mothers were, I don't, did you know they're both named Martha?
Wait a second.
So Patrick has five films and I have five films where we appreciate the way the Dark Lord is portrayed. Because quite honestly, both of us sold our souls so long ago. We take it for granted. It's just in the far background. And, you know, we know eventually we'll get our eternal comeuppance.
What is your fifth favorite movie to star the devil, sir?
Okay. Well, first of all, ranking these was very difficult.
And okay. I didn't really rank mine. So I just have five.
Yeah. Take the numbers with a grain of salt. Yeah. TCM made this easier, and I'm so glad that I spend the extra $10. Where I live now, you have to spend extra money to get Turner Classic Movies because they know that people my age want it. The other night, they were showing an entire evening of Dudley Moore films, and it was delightful because even though I own it on Blu-ray, I got to see Bedazzled again. And my number five devil film is Peter Cook as George Spigot in the original Bedazzled. Mm-hmm. I'm not the biggest fan of the remake, but the original's great. And I can only imagine it isn't more popular because the pace is so leisurely, or that maybe some of the British stuff doesn't transfer. Because every time I watch that movie, I'm blown away, not only at how thoughtful it is about the devil and things, but because Peter Cook and Dudley Moore came out of sketch comedy with Beyond the Fringe, it's sort of an artful way of writing a narrative movie that's actually a series of sketches. And every time the devil grants one of Dudley Moore's wishes, it becomes this reality and it becomes a sketch. And I'm blown away by the fact that every segment has them doing a different British accent. It's subtle, but it's there. In the frame story, Dudley Moore is sort of working class English. And then in the first wish, he sort of becomes this excitable Welsh intellectual. And it's really clever and it's really subtle. But what I really love in the movie is Peter Cook's very weird Satan. When he's not talking to Dudley Moore, he just engages in a series of shitty pranks. He walks past parking meters and they all instantly expire. And he forces the bottoms of grocery bags to drop out so people drop their groceries. And he's just always being generally shitty. It's clever. And in fact, there's a scene where he explains to Dudley Moore why he became the fallen angel, because he was sick of worshiping God for eons for no apparent reason. And that was getting boring and stuff. The film also has a really interesting depiction of the seven deadly sins, including Raquel Welch as Lillian Lust, the girl with the bust. And Dudley Moore did the music, which is interesting because just recently we were talking about The Long Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Long Goodbye, the score is by John Williams, but it's the same song done over and over in different styles. If you're really listening to the soundtrack of Bedazzled, the same thing happens. There's one main theme that actually gets sung during one of the fantasy sequences. And then almost all the rest of the soundtrack is a variation of that theme.
Very nice. I have seen this movie because I own the Twilight Time Blu-ray,
which is the one that I bought, because for a while it was really difficult to see.
Yeah. I've only seen it once, and I don't remember it super well, so I'm obviously due for a revisit. I missed it when it was on TCM.
And the film accurately predicted the rise of sort of punk rock, because at one point Dudley Moore wants to be a pop star, and so he appears on this sort of hullabaloo-like show in black and white, and he's got like a gold suit, and he's sort of old-fashioned showbiz. And then Peter Cook arrives to destroy that fantasy, and he's a singer named Dremble Wedge, and he sings a song called I Don't Care. And there's all these chorus girls singing, oh, I'm bedazzled. But the lyrics are, I don't love you. I don't like you. I find you terminally boring. And all the women go crazy over his indifference. And I think that's the best scene in the film. Also, the film was directed by Stanley Donen.
Yeah.
Who co-directed Singing in the Rain. So right. Talk about bona fides.
Yeah.
He's bona fide.
I'm bona fide. Well, this makes my number five pick very easy because I am the biggest fan of the remake. So I'll go with the Harold Ramis remake of Bedazzled from 2000.
Really?
Yeah, I saw it in 2000 and I was kind of like, eh, whatever. And then every time I revisit it, I appreciate it more. It's definitely like not as... It's a lot broader and a lot sillier than the original.
It's not as trenchant. I remember liking Brendan Fraser, not liking Elizabeth Hurley, but thinking that because it was Ramis, the individual segments are really sharp. They're really funny. I'm thinking of the drug dealer one.
Yeah, where he learns he can speak Spanish. And I mean, I like Elizabeth Hurley in the role. I think her casting comes as a result of somebody watching the original and being like, what if Raquel Welch was the devil? And then they just make Elizabeth Hurley the devil in a series of outfits. And Brendan Fraser, I think, just is one of those actors who commits 110% to everything he's in, as we're seeing now with his Oscar run for The Whale. If you're looking for an actual great Brendan Fraser performance, not that he's bad in The Whale. I shouldn't have said that, but The Whale is bad. But Bedazzled, he gets to give like seven great performances because he's in all these goofy little sketches. The movie is very silly, but because it's Harold Ramis, it also, I think, has a lot of heart to it, which I could see objecting to if you're a fan of the original, because that movie has no sentimentality and this movie kind of does. But I really like how hard Brendan Fraser goes in all of the sketches. And I think Elizabeth Hurley, you know, was one of those actors. She was obviously a very famous model. She dated Hugh Grant. became a household name because of that, and then became an actor and never really got a fair shake, I don't think, as an actor. She does Austin Powers. She does Bedazzled. And then she does some other interesting movies, but now she's doing like weird DTV Christmas movies with Billy Ray Cyrus. And I just think, you know, women have such a shorter shelf life in Hollywood and so fewer chances than men do. As evidenced again by the fact that Brendan Fraser is up for an Oscar this year and she's doing Billy Ray Cyrus movies.
Well, Christmas movies with Billy Ray Cyrus, maybe she signed a deal with the devil.
It's possible.
But I agree 100% about Brendan Fraser. I remember a family vacation trip. I think we went to Cedar Point Amusement Park. And at some point, we had some time on our hands, and we went to see George of the Jungle. And say what you want about that film, but Brendan Fraser commits, and he's the reason why. I haven't seen it in 20 years.
I haven't either.
He's the thing that made the movie watchable.
Yeah. This was a movie that I started rewatching when it came out on DVD, and Erica and I sat and watched it one night, and we're like, oh, this is way funnier than either of us remember. In large part because Brendan Fraser, again, is really funny. There's a deleted scene, a sequence that never made the movie that's just as funny as anything in the movie. I'm just a big fan of this movie.
My next devil portrayal should come as no shock, because it's amazing to me that this actor hasn't played Satan 10 or 12 times. It's the role he was born to play. It's Al Pacino in The Devil's Advocate.
I'm the devil.
Yeah, there's a sequel where the devil is blind and he gets to dance with this woman and get an Oscar. I'm so glad that Pacino made this during the hoo-ha period, not during the early 70s.
Where his voice is a little higher and more mumbly.
An underplay that this is the role that late period Al Pacino was born to play. In fact, now when I watch it, I keep expecting Pacino to turn to Keanu Reeves and say, "She's got a great ass." And so you can see, much like how, in my opinion, Jack Nicholson's performance in The Shining is very interesting, but sort of set him down the wrong road. I think Pacino and Devil's Advocate did the same thing, but that's just my preference for early Al Pacino over late Al Pacino. I almost wish that in Devil's Advocate, he had done something like, I think it's at the end of Jack and Jill when he does the Dunkin' Donuts commercial.
You are correct.
And suddenly it's his whole career in a minute and a half, because I guess Robert Smigel wrote that commercial.
Yeah.
And so throughout Devil's Advocate, I want him to sort of keep breaking the fourth wall and winking at us and giving us little pieces of other performances. But I remember when the movie came out, how much I liked it. And then there was all this controversy about the DVD because there's an elaborate...
it's like a painting or a sculpture, yeah.
Behind the Al Pacino character in his office, and they didn't get the rights and it was copyrighted. So it became very important to me to get the Blu-ray that wasn't altered, because later they went in and digitally did something so that the sculptor could not sue. So I'm a proud owner of the unadulterated Devil's
Congratulations.
Advocate, which I then proceeded to never watch.
That's like when I got the DVD of Swamp Thing with the Adrian Barbeau nudity that's accidentally labeled PG. Like, that's my prized possession.
That was a thing. And I'm starting to think, because I'm old and in my dotage and I listen to more and more music on vinyl, that though the jig would be up when I bought the damn thing, I think there's so many people who buy vinyl records as objects. The record really doesn't have to play. It has to be colored vinyl,
right,
or
of course,
come with extra cardboard or splatter vinyl, which is very popular. But you really don't have to press the record, because I wonder to myself how many people are spinning it. Of course, I could be wrong. Since we recorded the podcast, where I doubted that anyone had seen Mrs. Harris go to Paris. I have been deluged with emails. I'm not making this up. Emails and texts. Our very own Rosalie Lewis just sent me a text the other night saying that she was watching it and enjoying it. And I guess I was wrong about Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. I guess there are at least five people who have seen that film.
If a vinyl comes out and it's, let's say, $40 for just a black record, but it's $45 or $50 for the special edition, limited edition splatter variant, do you pony up for the variant?
Always.
Yeah.
Because you're selling me an object. I'm buying an object. If I wanted to listen to the music, I would shout the magic names
of
Alexa or Siri, and right. I'd be up. That speaker just came to life on my desk. Hold on.
And on everybody's desks at home.
Even the devil has no control over this. Do you know how many times on TV that sets off?
Yeah.
You would think that, like, remember for decades in Hollywood when they set a phone number, it was 555, blah, 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 blah. They should come up with a fake.
Right.
Alexa command that doesn't set every Saturday night after the musical guest on SNL.
Oh, right.
Say, interested in hearing more? Just say, and I have to dive for the remote to mute it.
Somebody should figure out how to reprogram those devices so that they talk to you as Al Pacino from The Devil's Advocate.
I'm going to play you this music now, and you've got a great ass.
So you want to watch Batman versus Superman?
It's an affirmation. The other night, we were watching an episode of Shrinking on
Apple TV. Yes, we've been watching that.
Which, are you enjoying it?
Yeah.
And Jason Segel was telling his
device
Siri to play a song, and so on the show it's playing, and suddenly in my room there's like a weird echo.
Phoebe Bridgers comes on.
That's the exact episode, and suddenly, and it's phased wrong because it took mine. It was weird, and I'm like, oh, so now I have to mute the show and tell mine, this is clearly the work of the devil. Back on subject.
Is Harrison Ford giving a performance on that show, or is that just who Harrison Ford is at this point?
I don't know. I'm a big Harrison Ford fan, but he is very old.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when they show him on the television show, it's not the most flattering angle or shot composition, and you're reminded he's in his 80s, right?
He might be 80.
And I think he's giving a wonderful performance.
Yeah, he's good. I just don't know if it's
in a part that seems designed for him. But yeah, he's sort of trademarked the whole gruff thing.
Yeah.
Although he did do a few talk shows to plug Shrinking, and you know, it's famous that he hates talk shows, and he was sort of tempering that. The single greatest Harrison Ford talk show appearance wasn't Harrison Ford at all. It was the night that Mark Hamill went on a talk show and did his Harrison Ford impression. You can see it on YouTube. It's otherworldly. It's like, oh, this is a very good actor who made three movies with this guy. He's got this guy down pat.
We did a show on The Devil's Advocate, I don't know, maybe a year ago or something. So I'm sure that I'm repeating something that I said on the show. But I remember seeing trailers and thinking, that movie looks kind of stupid. I'm excited to see it. And going to see it and appreciating how A-list the whole thing feels while still
very much. Very
leaning
much.
Into like what a B-movie it is. It's such trash material done with so much money and production value and performances.
Remind me, the Pacino character in the film has a flunky who's screwing up, and it's a fairly famous character actor. But
it's
in
Jeffrey
the
Jones as Eddie Bazoon.
Right, that's what I remember, that he's got this name, like when Rodney Dangerfield would talk about his doctor, his doctor was named Vinnie Blumbatz. And I always thought, I was at, what's the character in Devil's Advocate?
It's Eddie Barzoon.
Eddie Barzoon. And every time Pacino says it, of course, he's saying it in that fulsome Pacino voice. So every time he says it, what I hear is Vinnie Boombots.
All right. My next pick. Listen. listen, everyone.
Well, I know what one of yours is, so I'm just
it's
sort of
this
waiting
one.
For
it's,
it.
It's this one. I'll just get it out of the way now, because why make people wait for it? It's Little Nicky, and I'm not going to make the case that Little Nicky is a great film or a great comedy, but I will make the case that it's one of the last times that we got a studio comedy that was this weird and expensive. It's a real blank check movie. It's the last time Adam Sandler really tried to do something on a big scale, like for a Happy Madison movie. I'm not talking about the movies that he makes with the Safdie brothers or that movie right, where he's coaching basketball or whatever. I'm talking like a Happy Madison movie. I don't like the affect that he takes on for the Little Nicky character, but I admire the fact that he commits to it and does it for the whole movie. At no
and
point
the
do
famous
they have him get hit with a shovel a second time and fix the affect.
And the famous story is when the rushes started coming into the studio heads famously said, is he going to do that for the whole movie?
Well, there you go. And the answer is yes. The cast for this movie is insane.
Yes.
To the point where it has a Quentin Tarantino to burn. Like, he just shows up as a blind preacher running down the sidewalk screaming about how we're all going to die. It has a creative vision of hell. It has Harvey Keitel playing the devil as sort of a doting father.
The role he was born to play.
Right. He's literally falling apart through the entire movie because his two sons have escaped hell and now no new souls can get in. It is the movie that codifies the fact that Popeye's chicken is fucking awesome.
Well, and in that, you see the beginning of the road where the product placements just are hog wild.
Yeah.
One of the things I love about Little Nicky, and I love five or six things about Little Nicky.
Nice.
Is Hitler's Daily Punishment.
Right.
I always thought that was a very funny joke, very well portrayed visually.
Yeah.
In the, every day at 4 p.m., if you remember.
And he's dressed up in a little French maid outfit.
Which I don't think anyone ever mentions. That's just the ancillary joke, but that's, I like that, man.
There's a lot of stupid stuff in this movie, but then I think there's a lot of, like, out there stuff that's kind of funny, or again, I at least appreciate the effort, because what the Adam Sandler movie eventually becomes is minimal effort. And this is a comedy that's about maximum effort. They spent $90 million on this movie.
Well, and also it was from a time when it didn't seem like every comedy that got greenlit by a studio had to be one of five comedies. I mean, if you look at last weekend's Shotgun Wedding, it's
which
like,
I saw.
oh, what?
I saw Shotgun Wedding.
And?
It's not good.
Darcy Carden did an amazing number of talk show appearances to talk that film up. I'm thinking maybe because other cast members refused. But that Shotgun Wedding, you can imagine the pitch meeting, because it seems to me that that movie is half of this movie and the other half is this other movie that was a success 5 years ago.
Right. Part of this is just me being nostalgic for this period of New Line. This is right before The Lord of the Rings. And they are like on the precipice of becoming a major. They've had the Austin Powers success. They've got Paul Thomas Anderson as sort of their boutique guy, and they're willing to give Adam Sandler anything he wants to make a movie with them. And like I said, this is Adam Sandler cashing a blank check that bounces in a big way.
Did Little Nicky make money?
No, it did not. It made about half of its budget back.
And just briefly going back to Shotgun Wedding, am I mistaken, or did I not see a trailer for Shotgun Wedding in a movie theater quite a while ago?
I couldn't tell you. As far as I knew, it was always an Amazon movie, but that doesn't mean you didn't see a trailer for it, because maybe they were planning a theatrical release.
I think they were, and I remember both Jan and I thought that the trailer should not have given away the twist.
Okay.
And the trailer gave away the twist in spades.
Okay.
But that I chalk up to it being the work of the devil, because I don't know if you people know who owns Amazon, but ixnay on the evil day.
Right. So Harvey Keitel as the devil in Little Nicky is my number four.
And my next one I thought might make your list.
Okay.
Maybe it's on your list. Maybe
it might still, yeah, yeah.
The portrayal of the devil in Phantom of the Paradise by Paul Williams, which is interesting because Phantom of the Paradise is such a polyglot of different things. Just when you think it's Phantom of the Opera, well, it's not really, because it's also Faust. And so we have to show Paul Williams selling his soul to the devil, but then Paul Williams becomes the devil character who's trying to get other people to sell their souls.
Okay.
And I thought, in a film full of interesting ideas, because my God, one of the things I like about Phantom of the Paradise is that it's De Palma before he went all slick, that Phantom of the Paradise seems very homemade and cobbled together and like the work of a high school genius. And in this case, it's Brian De Palma writing the script and Paul Williams writing these crazy songs. That in the scene where Paul Williams sells his soul, the devil, spoiler alert, is him. It's him.
Right. The scene in the bathtub, are you talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think other films have done that, but not one I can remember. And I thought that was sort of imaginative and interesting, that I know when I sold my soul to the devil appeared as me, because clearly that makes some sort of ecumenical sense.
When I sold my soul, the devil was Elizabeth Hurley.
I was hoping for Peter Cook, just because I have a lot of fanboy questions about Beyond the Fringe and his participation in Yellowbeard and stuff. But I know Phantom of the Paradise, I think, is still one of your favorite films of all time.
Never heard of it.
And there's a cable station from my new cable company that shows it quite a bit.
Oh, wow.
And it's not one of those bullshit cable stations where there's commercials. This is uncut. Because the other night I was canoodling about because I couldn't sleep, and I started noticing the time slots that some of these movies were in on a nationwide TV channels like Movies, which I think is owned by the MeTV people. And it was like Goodfellas, and it was in like a 5-hour time slot. So you're going to see a lot of commercials for that sponge, that magical sponge that cleans everything. And you should avoid that. As I've said to our very own Adam Risky occasionally, it speaks to my sloth, speaking of the seven deadly sins, that I'll be watching one of these damn things, and it'll occur to me that I could save 2 hours of my life by simply walking to the office and grabbing the Blu-ray.
Yeah, I'm guilty of streaming stuff that I own.
I think since I moved, I've seen Phantom of the Paradise three more times.
Well, you're a lucky man.
Whatever this cable station is, no commercials, and they show it a lot.
What would it sound like if Paul Williams as the devil had to like give one of the ape laws?
Ape shall not kill ape.
There it is. Thank you.
I still remember, because if any of you are able to stream it, there's this wonderful documentary about Paul Williams that's only marred by the fact that it seems as if the filmmaker made the film only so that he could become friends with Paul Williams. But it's actually a very affecting portrait of this man who became very famous and sort of lost his way with drugs and alcohol and then got everything back at the end. It follows the narrative structure of Behind the Music. But Paul Williams once put on the ape makeup when he was appearing in Beneath the, I'm sorry, it's not Beneath, it's the last one.
Battle?
Battle, because they start with the letter B. He was appearing in Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and he convinced the studio to make him up as, I believe his character's name, Virgil, and he appeared on The Tonight Show in full ape makeup. And when he took the stage and sat down, he told Johnny he looked like that because of too many banana daiquiris. And in the documentary, the documentarian is showing him all these film clips from talk shows, and Williams just shakes his head because he knows how drunk and high he was.
Oof.
When he was doing all that, and that he just thinks it's horrible behavior now, and he regrets it. Paul Williams, or as my son sometimes refers to him, that little elf, just gives a wonderful performance in Phantom of the Paradise, and it makes me sad that if Phantom of the Paradise was some sort of enormous hit, we would have gotten more movies that were musicals where he did the songs,
yeah,
like Bugsy Malone, because clearly two of the highlights to Phantom of the Paradise and Bugsy Malone are the great songs that he wrote.
Yeah.
And did he also write the songs for the Muppet movie?
I don't know if he wrote all of them, but he might have. Obviously, I know he wrote Rainbow Connection. But honestly, maybe I'm looking it up now. It just says music by Paul Williams. So he very well may have written all of the songs.
He's a great songwriter. Trivia note, Rainbow Connection, the song that Patrick danced with his mother to at your wedding. That was a very sweet moment.
Yeah, thank you.
Then Erica gets out on the dance floor with her dad and dances to Sweet Child of Mine, and the whole thing was ruined.
Phantom of the Paradise, still one of my favorite movies ever made. One of the best movies of all time. And Paul Williams is amazing in it, and so are his songs. So I agree with everything you said.
There's a couple songs in that film that I actually know all the lyrics to, including, I think it's called Bye Bye Eddie Goodbye.
Yeah.
Which has one of my favorite lines in any song. Well, Eddie, you did it.
And you know who's playing the lead singer of the Juicy Fruits, right?
Archie Hahn.
Archie fucking Hahn.
And the sequence when the Juicy Fruits first appear and do the Beach Boys parody, and it's the split screen, that's a little mini movie in and of itself.
It's pretty incredible. There's all these weird connections between a lot of my favorite directors. Like Archie Hahn is in Phantom of the Paradise and then goes on to be part of Joe Dante's stock company. And what's his name? William Finley is in Phantom of the Paradise and shows up in a bunch of Tobey Hooper movies and a bunch of De Palma movies. He kind of crosses over.
You know what film we need to check out? I've never seen it. It must be very hard to get. But I was made aware of it because recently Cindy Williams passed away.
Yes.
And she was certainly very talented and very sweet. The film is called The First Nudie Musical.
I know of it, but I've never seen it.
And I only know about it because I believe it's in one of the Danny Perry cult movies books. That's Cindy Williams right before she gets Laverne and Shirley. I think the studio was very upset that that was one of her previous credits. And Stephen Nathan is in it. And Stephen Nathan was the original Jesus on Broadway in Godspell.
Hey, now.
So I want to call me twisted. I am the devil. I want to see Cindy Williams get naked with the Jesus from Godspell.
Although, based on the book, they don't strip. There's a book of the first nudie musical?
A book.
Didn't you say based on the book?
I'm sorry, that I know about the film because I believe it's
Oh, based on the Danny Perry
in
book.
one of the
I was
Danny Perry
like,
books.
they wrote a
Because
book of the first nudie musical?
Bruce Kimmel is also in that film. And I guess the plot is very Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, let's put on a show, but they decide that the show will be more popular if it contains adult material.
So it's about the making of Hair.
Pretty much. There's a scene where chorus girls are dressed as vibrators in elaborate costumes and they dance because, of course,
Positively ribald.
this was the 70s.
It is currently streaming on Tubi and Freevee, which are words, I assure you.
And Tubi, you watch it, but there's commercials, right?
Same with Freevee, which used to be IMDb TV.
Before I die, I will check out the first nudie musical. Notice there was never any second nudie musical.
All right, my next pick. What do I go with? I know. You so rarely see the devil portrayed as a vial of green liquid, and that's why I'm going with Prince of Darkness from John Carpenter, which is not so much a great portrayal of the devil as much as it is a fascinating conversation about the nature of evil and about how the devil might actually try to present him or herself on Earth. John Carpenter, famously got very involved in like studying metaphysics, and Prince of Darkness is a weird mishmash of metaphysics and religion and science, and it's one of these movies that I like more every time I see it. Even though I'm very aware that it kind of has the dogma problem, which is I don't have a way to visualize all of the ideas in my movie, so my characters are just going to stand around and talk about the ideas. But it has an amazing score, tons of atmosphere, tons of dread, super creepy. I really love it. I'd put it in my probably top five Carpenters. And the devil is a green liquid.
And you hit the nail on the head. Well, first of all, this is one of my honorable mentions, the jar of green goo from
Okay.
the darkness. But you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned dread, because I don't remember a lot about the movie. I think I've seen it twice, but I do remember that very few movies, I know Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me is another one, can establish this atmosphere of dread that really starts to get under your skin, where it's not interrupted by jump scares, but it's this steadily mounting tension that's really unnerving. And very few films have done that, but Prince of Darkness does that very effectively and has Alice Cooper as a homeless man.
True. The vial of green goo reprised its role in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze,
Ooh.
wherein the turtles all sell their souls to the devil as a vial of green goo.
All of those Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies make me go on a nostalgia binge, because when Jake was very small, like 2 years old, he used to watch those at his nanny's house,
Okay.
and he was just starting to talk. So he would come home and talk about titties, titties. What,
He's
Jake,
still talking about
are
titties.
you saying? Bebop, bebop. And we had no idea what the fuck he was talking about.
Just thought he was scatting.
And then we finally figured it out because Nanny had an older son who loved the turtles, and that was Jake's entree. But I get very nostalgic about the turtles.
I think you should revisit Prince of Darkness. My guess is the last time you saw it, if you were there for that screening, and I feel like you were, this showed the year we did the massacre at the Portage when Jan and Doug were there for the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
They showed it at like 6 a.m. I think you were back by then, and it didn't play well at 6 a.m. I think if they had played it at like 10 p.m. the night before, it would have killed. But at 6 a.m., it tested the audience's patience. but it's really good.
I'm looking at the Blu-ray shelf right now.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if I own it.
I feel like they just put it out in 4K.
The type is so tiny.
Mm.
I see Possessor. I see Princess Bride. I see Quadrophenia.
Well, it would be right by Princess Bride, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Pritzi's Honor. The producers. Anyway, no, I need to revisit that. It's going to be a fabulous F this movie double feature. Prince of Darkness, the first nudie musical.
Nudie musical.
My next portrayal of Satan is in cartoon form.
Ah.
God, I have memories of seeing this movie. It's from South Park, bigger, longer. And
oh, uncut. Nice. Okay.
And I saw it the day it was released.
Me too.
I was so excited to see it. And I don't think when I went, I knew it was a musical. I mean, a real musical with all these songs that they had written. And my biggest memory was that there were some 10-year-olds who had convinced mom and dad to take them because the parents were clueless. Mm-hmm. And they thought, well, it's a cartoon. And I wondered if Trey Parker and Matt Stone had put the Uncle Fucker song so early in the film because there was a stampede of parents dragging their kids out of the movie during Uncle Fucker. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Trey. And I was trying to remember because I thought just physically the way the devil was portrayed was such, I mean, it's such a standard big red guy with horns. But what really threw it into that category that makes me love what Trey Parker and Matt Stone do is, if memory serves, Satan is sleeping with Saddam Hussein.
Correct.
And Saddam Hussein has this crazy little voice.
Uh-huh.
And it's Saddam who's like using his lover's wiles to get Satan to do stuff. Like,
correct.
Satan is doing the whim of Saddam Hussein.
Right.
And the thought of Satan as a cuckolded homosexual lover
to Saddam Hussein.
Right. And of course, that's not what made the parents leave.
It right. was
Uncle right. Fucker who made them leave. So never
well,
mind.
They hadn't gotten to Satan yet because
this other thing is way more twisted. I love that movie so much. I still laugh that the Academy wanted to honor its achievement because the Academy, I mean, the people in the craft categories knew how special it was. And the only song they could imagine being performed on the telecast was Blame It Up. So that's the song that, out of all those songs,
right?
That Canada one is the best song, clearly.
Which they got Robin Williams to perform.
I still remember that, and actually, he like self-censored himself on one word.
Yeah,
he like came up with a way of beeping himself.
They were up against Amy Mann for Magnolia, and what won?
What one?
Phil Collins for Tarzan.
Oh my God.
If you guys want to hear us talk more about the Oscars, listen to this month's or last month's Patreon episode.
Because the Amy Mann song was
Save Me,
which is so
the best song ever
intrinsic to that movie. And just
in
terms of, because the other night, my wife and I were talking that oftentimes the Academy will get it wrong and then make up for it the next year.
Sure, yeah.
So we were trying to think of a movie that's more dependent for its effect on its soundtrack music. And the movie, of course, is Saturday Night Fever, which gets shut out at the Academy. It gets nothing. In fact, Jan was looking up, and there were obvious categories where it wasn't even nominated. And then the next year, or the year after that, the Academy tried to make up for that by giving Best Song to Last Dance from Thank God It's Friday.
A movie that we're still talking about today.
And wasn't the nomination for Blame Canada when Trey Parker and Matt Stone showed up in the dresses?
Yeah.
And then later admitted they were tripping balls because they had done acid before going into the...
That part I didn't hear, but I believe it.
I believe there's an interview on the YouTube machine where you can watch them admitting to that.
I went to see South Park Bigger, Longer, Uncut in 1999 as not a fan of South Park. I didn't really like the show. I hadn't watched it enough, but I resented it because I resented its fans at the time. They were these real kind of bro dudes at the college that I was attending who all were into South Park. And I was like, oh, you know, fuck that show. Fuck its fans. But I went to see the movie. Just it was like, I think it was the 4th of July that I went to see it during the day by myself. And I laughed so hard that night when I got together with some friends and they wanted to go see a movie and they chose South Park, I was like, sure, I'll see it again for the second time today. And so I saw it twice the day I saw it. It is one of, I still think, the best comedies of the last 25 years.
And I love the fact that one of its many themes, and I'm paraphrasing Kurt Vonnegut Jr., is that bad words don't hurt kids. They didn't hurt us when we were small. It's evil deeds and lying that hurt children, not bad language.
And Saddam Hussein.
At this point, I wish I could do the Saddam Hussein voice. I thought back then, and I still think that the voice they came up with for him was so funny and like almost like how Hitler is portrayed in the movie To Be or Not to Be, that it was an act of propaganda to present him in such a foolish light.
Right, right. Speaking of a big red dude with horns, my next pick is Ridley Scott's Legend, my very favorite.
That made my honorable mention list too, but for another reason. You have to admire the makeup job.
Well, that's the thing. It's my favorite sort of visual representation of the devil ever put in a movie. Rob Bottin's makeup is
incredible. I forgot that was Bottin.
His makeup throughout the movie, I mean, not just on Darkness, but on all the little goblins and trolls. And I have a huge soft spot for Legend. A couple of years ago, I went on like a real Ridley Scott bender. And so I watched both versions of Legend. I watched the theatrical cut, which runs about 89 minutes. And then I watched his director's cut, which runs about a half hour longer and reorders a lot of scenes and has a different score, I believe, by James Horner, as opposed to the Tangerine Dream score.
Right. That's the thing I most remember about the two versions.
And the theatrical cut is undoubtedly better in terms of the story is a little easier to follow. The score matches what's on screen. They wait a long time to introduce Tim Curry as Darkness. As opposed to the theatrical cut where he's literally the first thing you see. It's like credits and then Tim Curry. They want to just make with the devil because he's clearly the best thing in the movie.
We want the money to be on the screen.
Exactly. So it opens with him sort of lamenting whatever the fuck he's lamenting. I even like the theatrical cut. I love the Tangerine Dream score. I love the kind of weird dreaminess of the logic in the theatrical cut. But I really, really love the Tim Curry portrayal of the devil. As, you know, this guy who just wants a unicorn and a gal.
And I love Legend for two reasons. Number one, it finally gave Ridley Scott the unicorn insert that he needed for the director's cut of Blade Runner. So way to drop Peter to pay Paul and get one studio to pay for a very expensive looking shot. And then... I can almost never watch Legend again because unfortunately when Legend came out, Roger Ebert, who I miss terribly, wrote a review where he went on and on about Tim Curry in the makeup, I'm quoting, but that you could tell it was Tim Curry because of his full sensuous lips.
I remember that.
And that phrase sticks in my brain and lives there rent-free. So now, whenever I even see a clip from the film, I have to go to a psychiatrist to get this out of my noodle. Full sensuous lips. Okay, I said it.
It's why I can't watch Congo.
Because?
Tim Curry and his full sensuous lips.
His full sensuous lips. Talk about an actor who never phoned it in, though.
Yeah.
Tim Curry is amazing. I often watch the movie Clue, and I know that there are fans of our site who really like Clue. I watch Clue, and every time I watch it, I think, A, Michael McKean is the hidden weapon in this film because he's terrific, but he's underplaying. And also that Tim Curry's doing all the heavy lifting. I will say this, Clue is a more successful version of Murder by Death, which I think if our listeners revisit Murder by Death does not hold up well. Murder by Death makes Clue look like a masterpiece.
I like Clue. It's never quite as funny as I want it to be given the cast, but I really like it, and I do think it is funny in large part due to Tim Curry's performance.
And it made me wish I was back in Schaumburg for the holidays because they did it live on stage at the Mercury Theater.
Oh.
And I wanted to see if that sort of manic farce
Right.
pacing would actually be helped in a live theater where you knew the actors were there and actually running around and being silly. But I didn't get a chance. And I even forgot to tell you guys to go see it because I thought that might be a fun Christmas break thing and that the kids might like it. But
Yeah.
I think it closed.
We showed it to the kids over the summer, I think when Jan was here, and they liked it.
Yeah, there's a lot to like.
Yeah.
I won't spoil it, but there's a joke in the middle that has become an internet meme that's very, very funny.
Legend, I like in large part because of the hubris of Ridley Scott, where he makes Blade Runner, which is one of, if not the greatest science fiction movies of all time. And then he's like, well, I'll do the same thing with fantasy, right? And it doesn't all hang together because of the script, but I'm hard pressed to find many movies that look more beautiful than Legend.
I was going to say, and sometimes I think I'm confusing it with other films, but one of the things I most remember about Legend is in most of the scenes, isn't there some sort of shit flying through the air?
There's a lot of scenes where there's
like dandelion fluff and
right,
rain and
yes,
right, which
probably
is which,
ash because one of all the sets burned down.
well, I was going to say that was one of my first reactions to the Avatar sequel. And it contributed to the 3D. Avatar, The Way of Water, has a lot of scenes where there's shit floating through the air.
Sure. Finally knocked out of first place, by the way.
This is gonna become its own genre.
Shit flying through
Shit flying through the air
the
movies. What knocked Avatar out of the top
air.
spot?
Knock at the Cabin
Oh boy.
and 80 for Brady.
Well, in an earlier conception of this podcast, the devil was going to sign off at the end of it saying he had to go catch a matinee of 80 for Brady. And I read a review recently of 80 for Brady where the author spent most of his time bemoaning the fact that we have these four beloved actresses, and this is what we're going to put
Right.
them through
Right.
because this is America.
Give it a few more years and Elizabeth Hurley will be in 80 for Brady 2.
So I think I am going to see it this week, but
80 for
I'm,
Brady?
yes,
Okay.
because it's at theaters and it's in color.
I
And
don't even know the premise of that movie. I've never seen a trailer for it. I've seen a poster for it a million times.
I wish I was not going to see it ironically. I wish I wasn't going to see it like to squeeze the sponge and try to get some droplets of fun. But I'm very surprised because apparently it's based on a true story and it's about four elderly women making the decision to go to the Super Bowl.
Okay.
That's the plot.
All right.
And Sally Field thinks her fanny pack is called a strap-on, which is hilarious and embarrassing that a woman who has won two Academy Awards can't sit down with the producers and say, can we hire someone to do one more pass on the script and maybe get rid of these things? Because what is it? The Gene Siskel rule. I'd rather watch a movie of those four having lunch.
Yeah, right.
And talking about what it's like to be in one's 70s, 80s, and in the case of Rita Moreno, 90s
yeah.
in Hollywood. That would be a documentary that would be eye-opening and would contain no strap-ons.
Is Sally Field in her 70s?
I believe.
Oh, yeah, she is. She's 76. Wow.
I believe of the four, she's the youngest.
Well, that's what when I saw the poster, I thought, doesn't that age her up by about 20 years? Because she's co-starring along 91-year-old Rita Moreno, but she's 76.
Right. But this once again points out Hollywood's problem with age. In Hollywood's eyes, those four women are the same age.
Exactly.
Which is not 30.
Right. I rewatched Soap Dish recently, and Sally Field gives one of the best comic performances of the 90s in that movie, as does Kevin Kline.
Why did that every time I remember buying that on, I think originally the original release was manufacture on demand because the studio had, I saw that in a theater.
Me too. A couple times.
Talk about an amazing farce. Why didn't that, look at the cast. Why didn't that do better?
It's one of these movies now, though, that like, it's going to be a movie that time forgot because there aren't soap operas anymore, right? I mean, do people even know what it's making fun of? I had that thought watching. Oh, I hosted a screening of Tootsie a couple weeks back, and I was thinking to myself, does a younger audience even know what they're kind of goofing on here? You know, particularly with what's his name, the actor who can't act,
George Grizzard.
What is his name?
George Grizzard?
That can't be right.
The one who keeps kissing.
Yeah, the guy from Police Academy. I felt bad saying.
I believe his name is George.
The guy from George Gaines?
George Gaines, I'm sorry.
George Gaines, okay.
I don't know who the hell Grizzard is.
I don't either. But he was Lessard in Police Academy.
And so, you showed it at Elk Grove, and it played. Right?
It went over really, really well, but I was wondering, like, how are people going to react to this? There are no soap operas anymore.
Or
there might be one on the air.
No soap operas that people watch.
Right.
Because people have jobs now.
Ugh, jobs. Jobs are the worst. All right, so we're at your number one?
My mother used to do the ironing and watch Days of Our Lives, and she was part of the generation who called it her stories.
Sure.
This is one of my stories. My number one film, how could it not be? Portrayal of the Devil is in The Exorcist, where cleverly we don't see the devil unless that Captain Howdy subliminal is supposed to be the devil. But what we get is the devil possessing this young girl. And then in the director's cut, we get Max von Sydow explaining that the whole phenomenon is meant to demoralize us and make us think that we're shitty. But here I'm pointing out that the devil portrayal is actually a combination of Dick Smith's makeup and Mercedes McCambridge's amazing vocal performance that she never got enough credit for. Mm-hmm. There's scenes in that film, and I'm sure it has something to do with how old I am and how old I was when I originally saw it. But when she makes the drawer on the thing come out next to the bed and Karis asks her to do it again, and Mercedes McCambridge says, in time. That's creepy shit, man.
As you were talking about Mercedes McCambridge, I was like, oh, she's the one who like goes and does conventions and it's weird, but no.
No, that's I'm thinking
of Eileen Dietz, exactly.
Who was Linda Blair's stunt double, and because of the nature of the part, she's actually on screen in that movie quite a bit. In fact, in William Peter Blatty wrote a book about his experience with The Exorcist because he wrote the novel and he produced the film. And around the time of the Oscars, which of course always gets it wrong, all the Eileen Dietz stuff and Mercedes McCambridge stuff was, there was press about it and it was written up in newspapers and things back when those mattered. And Blatty thought that cost Linda Blair the Oscar because suddenly people were saying, oh, well, what you liked about that performance wasn't her. Of course, Linda Blair has done herself no favors. I remember her first flashback appearance where she was somehow there because of The Exorcist, but sort of trying to distance herself from The Exorcist. And I paid to tickets of a screening of The Exorcist where she would introduce the film. And she spent her time trying to convince herself that it wasn't a horror film. Her introduction consisted of a twisted argument that it was an ecumenical thriller which the audience wasn't buying. And later in the dealer's room, someone brought her something they had made, which was very beautiful. And she began to scream and say, take that away from me. I don't want to look at it. And at this point, I think one of the convention organizers had a talk with Miss Blair because she has been back to flashback. And I think now, at least in public, she embraces the fact that it's a beloved horror film.
Yeah.
And she was a big part of it. I can only imagine that the film has fans who are freaks. Who make her
like any horror movie.
But one of my former students is very into horror films and went to flashback very earnestly and honestly and genuinely and talked to Linda Blair about what the film meant to her and what she had gotten out of it. And had a really good interaction with Linda Blair. And that made me happy because certainly any former student who likes horror films is on my A-list.
I want to interview Linda Blair, but I only want to ask her about Night Patrol.
I want to interview Linda Blair, but I only want to ask her about her animal charities.
Which is kind of what she's like raising awareness for when she does these conventions, yes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I thought, which is cool.
No, I agree. There's some other pretty high, maybe I'm thinking of when Jamie Lee Curtis
did the
one Halloween signing where it was like, wow, talk about altruistic. It went to a children's hospital. And there's a special feature on one of the Halloween discs that really sort of shows you what an ordeal that was.
Yeah.
But thumbs up, Jamie Lee. What an
Academy Award nominee, Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yes.
As we now have to call her. My number one is my favorite devil movie ever made. Spoilers for the movie, because by mentioning it in this podcast, I'm spoiling the ending of it. But that is Alan Parker's Angel Heart, which is a great neo-noir that suddenly becomes a horror film at the end when you realize that if you hadn't already figured it out, that Robert De Niro's character, whose name is fucking Louis Cipher, is actually the devil.
Say it slow. I'll always remember there's a scene in that film where he's eating a hard-boiled egg.
Yes.
And I thought that was sort of iconic. That sort of becomes one of a string of films where very famous actors are called upon to play the devil.
Nicholson does it in Witches of Eastwick.
Well, I was going to say, which is another one of my honorable mentions, which we're actually name-checking here. I'm not the biggest fan of Witches of Eastwick, but there is one scene in Witches where Nicholson is so bothered. He's so frustrated that he sort of does this stamping dance that has him not running. He starts to stamp his foot, and he does so violently that he does a complete circle on the floor. And that's my favorite point in the film, because I think he's portraying all of American manhood when it gets frustrated.
Sure.
That you just become this dervish of angry nonsense. I'm trying to remember, because I still remember seeing that movie the day it came out. And obviously it got a lot of press attention because Cosby's daughter was in it.
Right.
In a sex scene. But I'm trying to remember.
Got her fired from the Cosby Show.
Oh, that did?
Well, wait, actually, I might have my facts wrong. Maybe it got her fired from a different world.
I remember that A Different World went on with the other cast and they kept doing it without her, but
Yeah. Bill Cosby, moral police.
it was a different time.
Yeah.
That I'm trying to remember at what point in that film the light bulb went on above my head and I
Oh,
kind of figured
Louis
it out.
Cipher.
But also I would argue
There's
that
a
one
better twist.
of that
Yeah.
one of the other reasons to like that film is that
Yeah.
the Nero thing really isn't the biggest twist.
Correct.
There's a bigger twist, which
Yeah,
we will
a
not
much
spoil.
better twist.
And that film was directed by
Alan Parker.
Wright. And that means it's full of wonder and art direction, and it's very beautiful to look at, and it drips with atmosphere. I believe it takes place in New Orleans,
It sure does.
if I remember correctly. Oh, and that in the spirit of screenwriters who think every name has to mean something, the Lisa Bonet character is named Epiphany Proudfoot. And Epiphany, of course, is a moment where you realize something. Oh, De Niro's in this movie. And Proudfoot is a translation of Oedipus. The
Right.
word Oedipus means swollen foot. And if you're into that thing, that might be a clue to help you figure out other secrets of Angel Heart.
As a kid, I wanted to see it not so much because Lisa Bonet was naked in it, but because I had read that, because I was probably 10 when it came out, I had read that they had to trim it back from an X rating. And anytime I heard that, I was like, well, I want to see whatever that is because I'm not supposed to see it. So now how can I? And it would be years. I probably wasn't in high school until I finally saw it. And I was just blown away by how great a fucking movie it is and how great, you know, Mickey Rourke in the zone, like, late 70s, most of the 80s, a little bit of early 90s, Mickey Rourke is one of my favorite actors. And this is my favorite Mickey Rourke performance of all of them.
He did some great acting, although I would argue that the sex scene is much sexier before it starts raining blood.
Well,
For me,
tomato, tomato.
the blood rain just ruins the mood. Mood is wrong. Mood is wrong.
I love Angel Heart. If you've never seen it, please, please seek it out because I think it's one of the great 80s horror movies.
And I also think there's a lot of people who have never seen it, that one falls through the cracks for some reason.
Well, it unfortunately got so famous for the sex scene and the controversy around the sex scene that I think it kind of swallowed up the conversation around the movie about how fucking great the movie is, you know. I'm trying to
And
find the
the sex scene is like 2 minutes out of
yeah.
110.
And I think if it hadn't rained blood, it actually would have passed with an R. But I could be wrong. I could be wrong. I don't know.
Well, I thought the whole RX thing was what Ebert used to call rumpy pumpy, that there was
What?
one specific image that the MPAA back then really didn't want to see, and the sex scene in Angel Heart is
Oh, yes.
that as Bill Hicks once called it, the hairy bobbin man ass.
I'm trying to find. I can't tell what.
I'm trying to find pictures of Lisa Bonet on the internet naked, and I just can't find them. Where are they?
She went back to the Cosby Show in 91. So she left the Cosby Show this year, goes to do A Different World. Goes back to the Cosby Show in 91, but gets fired for creative differences. But I can't really figure out the timeline. So,
Because at that point, Lenny Kravitz is whispering in her ear, be a revolutionary.
Lenny Kravitz, by the way, star of Shotgun Wedding.
Well, he's in it.
Yeah.
And
He's
more
like the third
importantly,
lead.
he's the subject of a lot of the anecdotes that the press people have given the cast to tell on talk shows, because apparently where they were shooting, they all kind of lived in a big house. One night, they took turns screening each other's movies.
Okay.
And one night, the entire cast of Shotgun Wedding watched Up in Smoke and Cheech cooked for them.
Oh.
So call me crazy. In the spirit of the stars of 80 for Brady sitting down for lunch and it being a documentary, I would rather watch a film about the cast of Shotgun Wedding getting high with Cheech Marin, eating his tacos, and watching Up in Smoke.
Yeah, me too.
That's the film that St. Peter is going to screen for me in heaven when I pass away. At 103 of natural causes.
Wow. Who else, what else is on your honorable mention list? I know we named a couple of them so far.
Thanks to your list, we name checked most of them. My honorable mention list was Tim Curry and his full sensuous lips in Legend, The Jar of Green Goo in Prince of Darkness, Jack Nicholson running in a circle in Witches of Eastwick, and then we have the F.W. Murnau version of Faust.
Okay.
Where at one point, Satan is presented as an impossibly tall shadow that overcomes the entire city. It's this remarkable visual shot in a great silent film. And then finally, I've never been a fan of the Omen films because I think they're a little ham-fisted and obvious that the Omen is sort of the exorcist for middle America. But I will say this. In the first Omen film, there's a scene where Damien's nanny is on a balcony and they're celebrating Damien's birthday. And the nanny says, she shouts this to the crowd below, "Damien, it's all for you," and does something. And back when I first saw the movie, that was one of the scariest fucking things I had ever seen in my life.
Really?
Just the way it's done.
Sure.
Especially the actress's decision.
Right.
To play it as happy and celebratory.
Mm-hmm.
The scene when The Omen was first released, God, I remember when that movie came out. It was crazy popular. The scene that got all the attention was David Warner being decapitated by the sheet of glass. Oh, everyone talked about that. That was, and the head rolls on the glass. So nice. But the nanny's scene is so much more affecting and so much scarier. I don't know. It may be my taste is different than other people's taste, but Damien, It's All For You is another thing that lives in my head rent-free.
I remember there used to be this show back when like Encore was a movie channel and it was called The Directors. They did a show on Richard Donner and I remember him talking about shooting a scene for The Omen where somebody falls from a great height and he wanted to establish that the height was dangerous. So he drops some glass
The goldfish bowl. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's when Lee Remnick falls off the ladder.
There we go. I couldn't come up with the name Lee Remnick. I'm sorry. The reason that he does the goldfish bowl is to establish the height and to make it seem very dangerous. And I remember thinking that was so smart and how much it reminded me of Tom Savini talking about when you want to kill somebody with a hammer, you have to miss the first time and use a real hammer to establish the weight of it so that when you swap it out for the fake hammer and the dummy head, we buy the illusion. I always thought that was so cool.
Richard Donner was very talented. And in The Omen, you get this feeling that the studio knows it's slumming in terms of the film they're making. So they're going to tart it up with Gregory Peck and Lee Remnick and all these A-list actors. But what they're really doing is sort of making a B-movie that's cashing in on The Exorcist.
Well, that's the devil's advocate. I mean, it's B-movie with A-list stars and production value and stuff. I just saw The Omen 3 for the first time because...
That's one with Sam Neill.
Yeah, for a thing that I'm doing. And I don't love any of these Omen movies.
No, at all. Talk about diminishing returns. I mean, the first one is no masterpiece, but after that, it's just let's wring the last ounce of marketability out of this
movie.
And then they remade it, didn't they?
They sure did. With Liev Schreiber and Julia Stiles.
But they only remade the first one. They didn't remake the sequel.
No.
I imagine what that would be like.
The Omen I lump together with the Amityville Horror, not because they're the same movie, but just because they're the same. In my head, they're the same kind of 70s period movies that I'm not interested in. But I actually love Amityville 2.
Around Christmas, Amityville, the original one, came out on 4K, and I rewatched it
after. From Vinegar Syndrome, right?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I think maybe it had been 40 years
since
my last screening. And I didn't think it held up at all. And one of my new neighbors in the condo is from New York, and she insists that it's real. And I keep telling her, well, no, there were lawsuits. And later, Jay Anson and the Lutzes came clean and said they made it all up to make money. And no, my neighbor insists, no, it's real. It's real.
That's too funny. This was a fun way to celebrate episode 666, J-Bones.
Oh, thank you. I thought you were going to say, this was a fun way of celebrating Satan.
That too. It's been quite a celebration of the devil. But thank you for doing this.
And his wondrous works. Thank you for being amenable to my text of a couple weeks ago. Why don't we talk about the big red guy?
It was a good idea. If you want more F This Movie content, go to fthismovie.com every day. If you want even more than what's available for free, subscribe to our Patreon. By the time this comes out, F This Movie Fest may have been announced. I don't know for sure when the announcement is coming. It will be March 4th. I'm not going to announce the lineup in case it hasn't come out yet, but I will tell you that it's March 4th. Go to fthismovie.com for more details. If the announcement hasn't happened, check back every day because it's coming very soon.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.